This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The events of April 15th and the week that followed shocked and perhaps changed this region forever. Our civic leaders, the marathon bombing, and the investigation that followed, including the lockdown of much of metropolitan Boston, all that represented a rare and difficult test for them.
On this program, we've heard from law enforcement officials, from mayors, from first responders, and from some victims. Today, our guest is Governor Deval Patrick, who led the Commonwealth through those difficult days.
During that dark week, Patrick spoke eloquently at an interfaith service about how the attacks at first challenged his religious faith and about his determination not to let an act of terror undermine a set of values that define the country's civic faith.
An attack on our civic ritual, like the marathon, especially on Patriots Day, is an attack on those values. And just as we cannot permit darkness and hate to triumph over our spiritual faith, so we must not permit darkness and hate to triumph over our civic faith. That cannot happen. And it will not.
Governor Deval Patrick speaking at an interfaith service in Boston just 3 days after the attacks on the Boston Marathon. And Governor Patrick joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston. Great
thank
to have you.
Thank you very much, Anthony and Meghna. Thank you for having me.
It's really good to have you. And listeners, you can join the conversation. What questions do you have for Governor Patrick about this past month in particular, about his leadership and about how the events of April 15th changed this city? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Governor, let me just jump right in. We've heard some very powerful firsthand accounts from a number of people about that day. And I want you to take us back to where you were when you first heard about these bombings.
On the 15th.
Yeah.
Well, I had been at the marathon earlier that day because part of my official duty is to crown the female winner, and because the mayor couldn't come, he and I had visited earlier that day in the hospital where he was confined that morning, and he'd asked me to crown the male winner as well, which is what the mayor normally does. So I had finished that and left around maybe 1 o'clock or quarter past, and run some errands and gone to get a workout, and I had an unusual open afternoon to myself. Diane was in New York, and remember it was a warm day, and I was going to do a little gardening at home, and I was on 93 going south, and my phone rang. It was my daughter, our youngest daughter Catherine, who was in the Back Bay, not at the marathon, but in the Back Bay, and she said, "Dad, I just heard two booms and everybody's running. What's going on?" And I said, "I don't know what's going on." And I turned to the state trooper who was driving me and said, "Do you know what's going on?" He said, "No, I don't know, but I'll check." And I said, I told her I'd call her back. We heard very shortly thereafter from Kurt Schwartz, who was the head of MEMA, the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, who was down at the finish line. Was in the tent, I think, when the first bomb went off, and he had gone out and seen the carnage and said, "There's been some kind of explosion. Appears to be two. We're going to set up a command post where you tell us to, and we'll go from there." And so we turned the car around. Of course, the troopers didn't want to go to the didn't want to take me to the finish line because we didn't know whether the attack was over. And they didn't think it was secure. So we went first to the State House and ultimately to the Westin.
You know, I'm just trying to think of all the preparations that someone like you in your position take before you take on a job, before you even run for governor. I'm just trying to imagine, is there any kind of preparation for, you know, what you had to take on that week?
Well, there's so many. It's a great question. It's something I've reflected on since. There are so many different dimensions to the experience that, if there were comparable experiences, they are varied in nature from which I drew. For example, before 9/11, the largest federal criminal investigation in history was the investigation in the attacks on black churches and synagogues in the South. And I had co-led that under the Clinton administration, so the importance of coordinating the law enforcement agencies is something I appreciated. And by the way, so did the heads of law enforcement. The business of, having a command post where there was some place where we were all going to make decisions is something I think we've learned from having had more than one weather event in the last 6 years. But there really was nothing quite like this in terms of just the...
Just the sheer number of people and departments
The number of people and departments, of course, grew exponentially immediately afterwards. But I think just the way it rattled us, the way it shocked and frightened people, the amount we didn't know. You know, when the tornado ended, it was over. We knew it was over. And the forecasters didn't see any other. We didn't know if there were other people, other devices, where they were. The information kept evolving in the course of the week and the investigation. In fact, even on Friday, when we'd identified the perpetrators, and there had been the shootout and so forth, and in the early hours trying to decide what to do about the so-called shelter in place. There was still stuff happening and facts developing in Boston, in South Station, in the Seaport area, on the train down to Connecticut, and all that stuff, you know, was a part of the fog of it all.
So. Governor, I thought you spoke really movingly about this idea of sort of protecting the ideas enshrined in this idea of our civic faith at that interfaith service. And we heard a clip from that a moment ago. And one of those values is openness, particularly when it comes to large public events like the Boston Marathon. And do you think in some unalterable way that the bombings did make a tear in our civic faith in a way and change who we are as a city and a state forever?
Well, I hope not. But I think that it is important for us to be vigilant, Anthony, but without fear. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I don't think that any of us is ready or ought to be ready to surrender the joy and you know, sense of moment of those large civic gatherings, whether it's the 4th of July or the marathon or, you know, arts festivals or what have you. But I do think that there are added precautions that are important for us to take. You know, every single year after a large event like that, law enforcement does an after-event analysis of what lessons were learned. And they make adjustments, many of them unseen by the public, but they make changes in planning for the next year. That's particularly painful and bloody and tragic lessons from this last marathon, but I think those will be incorporated into other. I know those will be incorporated into other events going forward.
Sure. Well, let me ask you about some of those practical lessons. Last week there were some hearings in Washington at the House Homeland Security Committee, and there were some difficult questions there about what the FBI knew about the suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev and whether that information should have been shared more openly or more quickly, I guess, with Boston police. Former Senator Joe Lieberman said basically the system established after 9/11 to protect the country failed. Do you agree with that fairly quick assessment there on the part of Joe Lieberman? And if so, how did it fail and how can it be fixed?
Well, I think that the importance of sharing information and doing so promptly cannot be overstated. That point is well taken. And obviously, I think everybody wishes they had known the information that was known before the bombings. Now, having been briefed thoroughly on the investigation, I'm not sure that information is information that would be so-called actionable, meaning that, you know, most of the concerns, as I understand it, were concerns by Russia about the radicalization of the older Tsarnaev and his behavior in Russia, not back here in the United States. But even after the interviews and the information gathered in the course of the interviews, unless we are prepared to say that anybody who might be a threat should be followed and you know, under surveillance, even on the vaguest information or alert, then I think there is a question whether that information would actually have made a difference. But I do think still we want a way to to gather information and make it useful. You know, there are 750,000 people on the terrorist watch list.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to
imagine.
So
you can't follow them all. You can't.
Well, that's right. A point. You know, yeah. Has it become the sort of thing one does by default? Do you just, if there's the slightest suspicion, do you put them on the list or on some list in order to have a kind of a CYA back in the agency? So I think that the importance of sharing information is obvious, is critical, and has to be done better. But I also think there has to be some discernment in that information so we know that what we're sharing is really valuable.
Let me ask you about the police response, which has been much praised, and rightly so. There's no doubt that, among other things, there were all kinds of acts of heroism, and in the end, they got the bad guys. But should we be concerned that in the end there, we're talking about one kid who was able to shut down a major American city?
Hmm.
And are we worried that, should we be worried that that might even send a message to other would-be terrorists out there that it doesn't take much to bring this society to a halt?
Well, I wouldn't make too much of this one example, Anthony, for the following reasons. Hmm. One, we didn't know who we were dealing with or how many people we were dealing with until very, very late in the game. Even on Friday, that Friday, when we I've heard it described as the lockdown. You know, in fact, I asked people to stay inside. I didn't order anybody to stay inside, and it was limited in time in the sense that we needed to do the door-to-door in the perimeter in Watertown. And the reason we asked for the neighboring communities is because it took some time between the shootout and to organize that perimeter so that we were concerned about flight to the neighboring communities. But it didn't start out being Boston. To the extent of being beyond the neighborhood of Alston Brighton, which was the abutting neighborhood. We extended it to Boston in time for the announcement, and this was between 4 and 5:30 in the morning because there was other information about other activity in Boston that we were afraid was related. So it's back to my point about a lot of information coming in, not all of which turned out to be relevant, but you didn't want to or related, that is, didn't want to take that chance at that time.
And clearly, guys who were tossing bombs and so on and so forth, plenty of reason to be worried about risks that you wouldn't want to take. I'm curious, though, how difficult it was for you. You don't want to call it a lockdown, fair enough, but the shelter-in-place decision, given your commitment to sort of open society, did you have to think hard about that?
Sure.
I mean, is that something that you needed to weigh carefully?
Sure. Well, the biggest issue was the first issue that came to me. Remember, law enforcement is in charge of the investigation.
Right.
The first issue that came to me in the, I think, 3 o'clock hour. So I got my first call Friday morning at 1 a.m., not too long after the shootout, and then I got hourly updates. And the first question that came was how to suspend T service in and out of the Watertown neighborhood so that we would prevent a means of escape, flight. And then that led to questions about how long between, as I mentioned earlier, between the shootout and the setting up of the perimeter, so because you couldn't know whether the perimeter was hard at that point. And how far can you get if you're traveling on foot? And that's what led to the greater Watertown area, to the whole of the town and the surrounding communities. So the original decision was to suspend the T service into and out of Watertown once it was due to start that morning, I think at 6 o'clock, and to ask people in the perimeter in Watertown to stay indoors, and others to exercise caution. By the time of the morning press conference, which I think was at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, we had this other information about activities in the Fenway, in South Station, and down on the Seaport, and so it seemed like we were dealing with something much broader, or might be. And it's very hard surgically to shut down the T into and out of Boston. So that then led to the decision to shut it all down, at least until they finished the door-to-door in Watertown. and to ask everybody to exercise extreme caution, stay indoors if they could. We knew we couldn't keep it going forever. And around about 3 o'clock or so, I think they were, I want to say maybe 70% done in Watertown. And we were looking ahead to when they would be done door to door. And if they hadn't found him by then, saying to people, look, we're basically back to where we were on Tuesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Go about your lives, but just be really careful because we have an active search underway.
Listeners, we're talking to Governor Deval Patrick about the Boston Marathon bombing and that week that followed. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. Governor, if it's okay, let's take some. We've got some callers lined up. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Somerville. Hi, Dan. You're on the air with the governor.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. How are you?
Okay, Dan. How are you?
Good. Good to talk to you, Governor. I just wanted to raise the question. I think that it was handled exceptionally well. Clearly, they got the suspects. And I appreciate that the question of, you know, the bringing the city to the halt and how that, you know, is a precedent. But I wanted to raise the question of the Fourth Amendment and how the police were able to enter homes during the search, whether or not you think that would be, you know, something that would be a risky precedent to set for the future, and where you think that fits in with all of this.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who has spent some of his professional life litigating the limits of government power, I can tell you that none of these decisions were taken lightly. I don't remember all of my, or I'm not current on all of my Fourth Amendment precedent, but I believe that the police have the authority to search when they are searching because of flight from an active and violent crime, which is what this was. I don't know the answer, Dan, as I sit here, what would happen if someone at their door said, no, you may not come in. But I don't think actually anybody said, no, you couldn't come in. I think people were pretty worried about it and cooperated, and that's why I take pains to thank the public for cooperating as they did. And frankly, Dan, I think if we'd had a lot of experience with this and a lot of false alarms and so on, then we'd be learning from that experience too, and showing a lot more restraint in the future about requests as extraordinary as these past ones.
Dan, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Joan, who's calling from West Boylston. Hi, Joan. You're on the air with Governor Patrick.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Governor Patrick, I have just an odd question, I think. Other than the capture of suspect number two, tell me what you think was your best moment, and you can be you personally or your collective view of, you know, all the folks engaged in the whole endeavor.
Wow.
What was your best moment during this nightmare?
Wow, Joan.
You got him thinking, Joan.
Can I answer you in 5 or 6 or 7 years? Because I think I'm still processing it, and the investigation is not over. I mean, there's a lot of work chasing down leads. There are two things maybe that stick in my memory. I don't know if they were best moments, but they made an impression on me, Joan. And one was you had all these, I don't know, hundreds of law enforcement on Friday in Watertown. And really wound up. And when the suspect number two, so-called white hat, was identified in the boat, hundreds of heavily armed police officers ran to the Franklin Street area where the boat was. And one state trooper said to me after the fact, he said, any one of them would have gladly put a bullet in the guy. But when they were told to hold their fire, every one of them did. And when he was apprehended and put on the gurney and wheeled right past all of these folks with their long guns and pistols and flak jackets and adrenaline pumping, as the state trooper put it, not one of them pointed their gun, spit at him, punched him, nothing. Everybody showed restraint, and I think that was an indication, an example of the system working. And then I think the other thing, which for on a totally different level, which was had a big impact on me, was the interfaith service, because it was, I think, a real healing or the start of healing for a lot of people.
Governor, I have one last question that I think we have time for. I know we've got to send you on your way in just about 2 minutes here, but this sort of is a follow-up almost to Joan's question, and my apologies if it puts you on the spot because it's another big sort of question. I'm wondering what personal lesson did you learn about leadership in a time of crisis?
One thing about crisis is that everybody wants answers, and little, if any, of the actual facts are any good. Meaning, it's, you know, when you're in the midst of it, you're in the midst of it, and it's still unfolding, and so you can't tell the whole story because you don't know the whole story. And so I think conveying, I think really keeping your head while others around may be losing theirs. May be pretty key, because it's impossible to get all the information and the facts if you yourself are hysterical.
And are you just talking about people in my profession sort of clamoring for the facts?
No, that wasn't a dig.
I didn't take it that way, but I meant you're talking about everyone sort of involved needed to come to you for information that you just didn't have at a certain point.
Right, and I think the general public wants information, and I think the temptation to fill that information with speculation and rumor and innuendo and so forth is huge. I think, you know, there were some tensions. Tension may be an exaggerated term for this, but there was some difference of opinion about how often to brief. Because when the investigation was really pumping and they were starting to get leads and so forth, you know, law enforcement, they have a job to do and they need to do that job. And but meanwhile, a lot of people wanted us to show up in front of a microphone and just say, "Look, we don't have any more." But You can try your questions. We'll tell you what we know, but we can't tell you very much.
Well, Governor Deval Patrick, thank you for your leadership during that week, and
thanks
for coming in and sharing some stories with us, and we hope you come back real soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Governor Deval Patrick, Governor of Massachusetts. Stay with us. Up next, we get an update on the progress of two brothers who each lost a leg in the Marathon bombing. Stick with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.